Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to be talking with three individuals, one in Baltimore, one in Washington, one in Brooklyn, concerning the ongoing series on the power, influence, and corruption of big business, a look at neoliberal free trade agreements and partnerships. Who do they benefit? Who do they harm? Our guests will include Kevin Zeese. Kevin is an attorney and political activist. He is the co-director of its Our Economy, director of Come Home America, an organizer for the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., and one of the original developers of Occupy Washington. He's worked for 30 years on drug policy reform and serves as the president of the organization Common Sense on Drug Policy. In 2006, Kevin ran on the Maryland ballot for the U.S. Senate with the Maryland Green Party. He was Ralph Nader's press secretary for his 2004 presidential campaign and worked closely with Ralph Nader's group, Democracy Rising, to oppose the Iraq War. Among his activist work is challenging the Chamber of Commerce and Karl Rove's America's Crossroads organization, seeking to overturn Citizens United and efforts to bring Rupert Murdoch to justice for phone hacking. He has a degree from SUNY Buffalo and received his law degree from George Washington University Law School. And he has contributed articles with Dr. Margaret Flowers that appear in Counterpunch, Truth Dig, Common Dreams, and the Washington Post and Alternet, and other progressive news sources. And he also co-hosts Clearing the Fog with Dr. Flowers, and his websites are comehomeamerica.us and itsoureconomy.us. He will be joined by William Warren is a senior trade analyst for Friends of the Earth in its Washington, D.C. office, where he focuses upon protecting the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements. He contributes to the policy discussion about trade and environmental issues as they arise in community forums, the U.S. congressional debate, the federal agency process, international negotiations, and litigation before international trade investment tribunals. Prior to joining Friends of the Earth, he was a policy director at the Forum on Democracy and Trade and was an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He has also been a senior fellow at the Harrison Institute of Public Law. In these capabilities, he studied the impact of global trade and investment agreements on the authority of the legislatures and other democratic institutions. He also conducted public education programs and served as a consultant on trade policy for legislators and other elected officials in the United States, as well as parliamentarians and Latin American Canada. He has degrees in politics and public administration from the University of Illinois and also a doctor of jurisprudence from the Duke Law School. And he is in Washington, D.C., and he publishes frequently in Environmental Law Reporter, Investment Treaty News Quarterly, State Legislators Magazines, and Friends of the Earth blog. And his work can be found at Friends of the Earth website, foe.org. And our final panelist today will be Adam Weissman. Adam has been a human and animal rights activist for two decades, and he is a founder and organizer of Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, which is a grassroots activist project addressing the threat posed by free trade agreements to animals, the environment, safe and sustainable food, and the civil rights of protectors of the environment. He is the Global Justice Representative for Trade Justice, New York Metro, a coalition of organizations from diverse social movements collaborating to resist the current proposed international trade partnerships and other trade agreements built upon the NAFTA model. His organization's websites are tradejustice.net and gjae.org. I welcome all of you to our program, and we're going to begin with you, Kevin. When we look back upon the free trade agreements during the Clinton administration and all their promises, and promises that were carried forth by the New York Times, The Nation magazine, and other organizations, and the NAFTA, CAFTA, GATT treaties, the World Trade Organization was founded during Clinton's watch in 1995. And therefore, the corporate interests at that time, we're talking about two decades ago, were focused on actual trade and trade protections, which provided the U.S. with an upper hand since it holds the greatest voting and veto power. Today, with the new Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TTP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or the TATIP, we're learning that little has to do with trade, and everything has to do with national government's deregulation to further bolster private corporate interests and profits and power. Now, on the surface, one might perceive the earlier agreements and the new proposed partnerships being negotiated this week as different monsters. However, it is my personal belief that these new international partnerships are merely a continuation of the agreements signed into law by Clinton, and how easy it was at the time to offer pork barrel projects, which I remember because I was challenging them on this program, in support of the legislation from people who had previously promised not to sign such treaties. We can also look at what was the ultimate outcome. How did we and the American public and the trade unionists and the people of Mexico benefit from NAFTA? We were told it would give us at least 1.6 million new jobs, improve the quality of life and the standard of living for Americans and people in Mexico and Canada. How did that work out? How did CAFTA work out? How did GATT work out? How did the World Trade Organization's impact upon the United States and other countries work out? It seems as though we are fanatical in our pursuit of solutions without ever looking at the results of our efforts. So the emphasis is never on the results. It's always on, we meant the best. We did our best. So I'm finding the same financial and corporate interest groups today engaged in these agreements as 20 years ago, and I see no good coming from the current Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Agreements. I feel that they will even be worse because I feel that the sovereignty of American laws, both at the local, state, and national level, will be usurped. And therefore, once this is signed and once this is done within a relatively short period of time, within 5 to 10 years, you would have almost no limitations upon the corporate plundering in the United States. That is my opening interest to you. Take the forum from there and give us your perspective on these, please.
Well, I think your intuition, Gary, thanks for having me on the show. Good to hear your voice again. I think your intuition is exactly right. These agreements that are being negotiated by President Obama and negotiated in secret are a continuation of the trade agreements from the Clinton era and before. And they really are about corporate power and will undermine the sovereignty of nations and the local governments as well. People will no longer have the ability to protect their environment, to protect their food and their health care, control energy companies or regulate banks. These agreements are a way to transfer power to corporate interests, large transnational corporate interests. I mentioned that this was being done in secret, and I think the reason for that is because people know that these agreements don't work, that they don't live up to their promises, and if people saw what was being negotiated, there'd be an uproar. There have been some chapters or portions of chapters or negotiating positions that have been leaked and published by WikiLeaks and other sources, and they show about the worst that we could imagine. In fact, the environmental chapter that was leaked shows that it's even the Trans-Pacific part is even worse than the agreements reached by President Bush, President Bush II, during his negotiation of these kinds of agreements. There's absolutely no enforcement provisions to protect the environment in these agreements, and so the environment at a critical time in our history, where ecological destruction is at a very dangerous level, and we're, of course, at the tipping point, if not over it, with climate change, there'll be no environmental enforcement ability under these agreements. And so we're pushing on two fronts to stop this. First, we are pushing for transparency, and we don't believe that secret negotiated laws are consistent with democracy, and By the way, these laws are secret except for the 600 corporate advisors who are advising the U.S. trade rep and able to suggest edits to the document. So they're not just they're seeing it live time, able to make changes to support their own interests, which makes this impossible to correct. So we're pushing for transparency. We're pushing for ending the secrecy as one step. The other step we're pushing for is not to give President Obama fast-track trade promotion authority. Fast-track really undermines the Commerce Clause, which gives the responsibility to Congress to negotiate trade, and really fast-track takes the Congress out. It allows the President to sign these agreements and then Congress, before Congress even sees them, and then Congress has a short amount of time, 60 to 90 days, depending which house you're in, to vote up or down with no amendments. This is inconsistent with the Constitution and gives way too much power to the executive branch, where we should have a shared power here in dealing with trade. And, of course, that because there's no time, it means no real hearings. It means that the public does not get informed and we get kept out of this. And so it's an anti-democratic process to put in place laws that undermine our sovereignty and our democracy. So we're opposed, and the trade negotiators are in Washington, D.C. this week. They came in on Sunday night, and they'll be here till Thursday. We were out Sunday night at the U.S. Trade Representative doing a light brigade show with all sorts of messages to get that out to the public so the public gets more aware of what's going on. And on Monday, we did a sit-in to blockade the entrance to the U.S. trade rep and greet the negotiators as they came in and let them know that fast track was dead, because that increases the power of other countries to say no to President Obama, and also let them know that we want to see the text, that the secrecy is not consistent with democracy. That afternoon, we were joined by Friends of the Earth and numerous unions and public citizen and other groups. A couple hundred people were out there joining us at a noontime rally, marched around the building, and let the trade representatives see that there was strong opposition from important groups in the United States to further let them know that the fast track's not going to happen, so they should not negotiate with President Obama and give up their rights. There's been real – one of the leaks, by the way, shows that the United States takes the most extreme position of the negotiating countries, the most corporate rights of any country in the room, far away from even, you know, close allies like Australia, which are very corporate. But even those countries are left in the dust by the extremism of the Obama administration when it comes to corporate power. So I think we can stop this, by the way. And the main group that I work with on all this, It's Our Economy, and the other projects you mentioned are actually part of this group, is Popular Resistance, popularresistance.org. People can go there and sign up to get on the list to be part of these future protests. There'll be many. The next big battle is the 2015 Congress. I think we can win there as well. Despite the increasing strength of Republicans, I think we can stop fast track from getting through the Congress. So I think we're on the verge of victory of this, and I hope people get involved and make sure it doesn't happen so we don't look back on this in 10 years and see the disaster that it will be.
I appreciate those insights. We'll come back to you in a little bit. Let's now go over and say hello to Adam. Nice to have you with us today, Adam.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adam, would you add to what Kevin has said, and also, on the one hand, these partnerships are attempting to implement regulations that put individual nations into a straitjacket, and while also deregulating national interests, many which are in place to benefit the individual national populations and consumer interests and concerns. Can you provide us with a larger, broader picture that defines the overriding corporate agenda behind the TTP and the TATIP? And these partnerships are finalized and ratified. What do you perceive to be the largest threats to the civilians of the nations who sign on to it? And for the man in the street, what might be the impact?
Well, I think what we need to understand about these agreements is that at the heart of them, this is a way for, these are really a Trojan horse for corporate power. This is a way for corporations to put into law all the things that if they were not bundled in these secret agreements, the public would never accept. So built into these agreements, the public rejected wisely SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, all these rules that attack internet freedom. So tucked into this trade agreement are attacks on internet freedom in the name of corporate intellectual property. Tucked into these agreements are intellectual property rules that will limit access to life-saving medicines, tucked into these agreements is an investor state dispute resolution system that gives makes corporations more powerful than nations. Under TPP and really many of the trade agreements going back to NAFTA, corporations have the ability to, when they feel that our public interest regulations interfere with their expected future profits, go to a system of international tribunals, either through the UN or World Bank, and demand monetary compensation for what they believe is the full loss of their expected future profits based on their inability to profit when we say that their practices endanger our environment, threaten our safety. Really, this is a system designed to eviscerate public interest legislation. We've seen case after case of this in practice. This week, while these negotiations are going on in D.C., we also have climate negotiations going on in Peru. And ironically, while negotiators in the U.S. are meeting on addressing climate, in D.C., they're working to undermine those same goals. We've seen time and again that these investor rules are a very effective tool for the corporate polluters to attack our environment. In Peru in particular, in fact, there's a case where a Peruvian smelter site, which is deemed one of the 10 most toxic sites in the world, the Peruvian government demanded remediation three times. The company, after extension after extension, finally the government put its foot down, and the Peruvian corporation, which is backed by a U.S. investor, which is ultimately owned by a U.S. investor, Ira Rennert, went to one of these international trade tribunals demanding monetary compensation for the audacity of Peru saying that they should have to clean up this toxic smelter site. In El Salvador, there's a similar case under the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. Under the U.S.-Central America Free Trade Agreement, there is a case where El Salvador is being sued for something like half of their national treasury for not letting a mining company mine using toxic chemicals near the river that is their largest source of drinking water. So these rules are really designed as a way to undermine democracy and undermine sovereignty in the name of corporate interests. Our ability to pass selective purchasing legislation, to have control over our government procurement, can be potentially attacked by these trade agreements. If we want to pass prevailing wage laws or buy local rules or green purchasing rules at the state level, that can potentially be affected by these trade agreements. Previously, states have committed to abiding by the procurement rules built into these trade agreements, and these rules are really designed to limit the ability of governments to pass rules that improve our quality of life but may not be to the interest of corporate of corporations. Our food safety rules are under attack by these trade agreements. One of the things being pushed for is an equivalency standard that will force us to treat foreign food inspection standards as comparable to our own, even when they are in fact not. We'll see an increased flood of unsafe food imports potentially under TPP, things like Vietnamese farmed shrimp, which is notoriously toxic. Testing has found time and again toxic pesticides banned in the U.S. In this shrimp. At the same time, the U.S. is pushing other countries to lower their food safety standards to some of the levels that our corporate agribusiness has pushed them to. So instead of trying to level the playing field across the board at the top level, higher standards across the board, which is what Obama claims these agreements are about, when he calls them high standards trade agreements, we're doing just the opposite. So ractopamine is a chemical that's been banned in 160 countries. This is a livestock food additive that was originally developed as an asthma medication, and then it was not successful at that, but was repurposed as a livestock drug to promote lean meat development in livestock. That's been banned in 160 countries because it's found to be both unsafe to consumers and cruel to the animals, causing suffering and disease in the animals. The U.S. has not banned this chemical and is now trying to strong-arm countries into dropping their ractopamine bans on the importation of meat containing ractopamine as a precondition to participation in this trade agreement. Similarly, with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the trade agreement with Europe, The pork industry is demanding science-based standards that include such things as Europe's animal welfare regulations, which are at a higher level than the, which are inadequate, but are at least higher than the atrocious lack of regulation of the suffering of animals in U.S. factory farms. The U.S. Pork industry does not want that as any kind of barrier to their ability to export cruelly produced pork from tortured animals to Europe, so they're lobbying to ensure that no animal protections will be part of that agreement, and in fact that they have guaranteed market access with their cruel meat products. For workers, what these trade agreements are sold as driving prosperity. Just the opposite is true. The Center for Economic and Policy Research found that 90% of U.S. workers will see their real wages lowered as a result of these trade agreements, and the 10% that will not, we can guess which sector of the public that is, and you'd be correct. The richest people will benefit. The average working people will not. And that's really who these, but really that's what these trade agreements are about, not are ultimately creating wealth for the top elites, not for working people, something that we've seen time and again in trade agreement after trade agreement. NAFTA, after all, was promised to us as a job creator and, of course, did just the opposite. Not only did U.S. workers lose jobs as factories moved south of the border, but farmers in Mexico lost their livelihoods as U.S. corporate subsidized agribusiness was able to flood their markets, destroy traditional agriculture, and destroy communities, forcing a wave of immigration to the U.S. where Mexican workers could be exploited as undocumented workers simply as a matter of survival when they could no longer live in their own communities thanks to corporate agribusiness. So I could go on. I don't know how much more you want me to add, but this is only I'm only really scratching the surface here.
All right, let's take a look at a few of these. Let's go back and take a look at the promises of NAFTA that you alluded to and the reality of it, both environmentally and as far as quality of life and what it did for the average worker. Then tie that into the promises made here. Also, behind the scenes, our State Department under Hillary Clinton was strong-arming governments around the world. We found this out through WikiLeaks, where the cables were shown that they were threatening countries with economic sanctions if they did not allow genetically engineered foods into their countries, countries that didn't want GMO foods. Now, the public doesn't know when you suddenly open the door and allow GMOs in, what was the rationale? And here it was extortion. Here it was a form of pressure being placed by Washington. No one was held accountable for that. And clearly they were, I don't know if they bordered on illegal, but they were certainly unethical and immoral. Now, if we had that happening at all the countries where we wanted to exploit GMO foods in those countries that didn't want them, what is the likely outcome if we have a treaty that then deregulates any of these safety standards so every country would be vulnerable to having GMOs in them, even though up to this point they might have been banned? Those countries that are part of this treaty wouldn't have any say-so, because I understand that this treaty has been heavily influenced by deregulators, including the genetically engineered food group. Would you address that, please?
Absolutely. And I think one thing that people need to know is that what the former U.S. chief agricultural negotiator for the U.S. Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, appointed by President Obama, is a guy by the name of Islam Siddiqui, who comes out of CropLife. CropLife is the industry group for the genetically modified food industry, for the life sciences technologies. So this is a literal case of the fox guarding the hen house, or a figurative case of the fox guarding the hen house, where the actual lobbyist, the for these corporate interests, is actually put in charge of these negotiations. Monsanto is part of an unholy alliance of corporations called the U.S. Business Coalition for TPP. The U.S. Business Coalition for TPP, there is a massive organization of some of the ugliest, most notorious human rights and environmental violators on the planet, companies like Cargill, Chevron, Monsanto, Halliburton. And these corporations come together to push for their range of interests to be served through these trade agreements. CropLife, in fact, the group that I mentioned earlier, is one of the corporate interests that is part of these negotiating council, sorry, these advisory committees that Kevin mentioned before. These are the people who have the insider track access to the negotiating text, who, while our members of Congress in order to see these negotiations, after finally after raising an enormous stink, finally were permitted to go into a closed door room, not take notes, not take take pictures of texts, not bring staff, and were sworn to secrecy on what they saw in this room while having a U.S. Trade Representative staffer staring at them as they were looking at the text, memorizing what they can. These advisory committee representatives, including CropLife, have, at the click of a button, the ability to access these negotiating texts on their computers and then provide their input to what positions they want of the U.S. negotiating team. So this really is an insider track negotiation for the corporation, shutting out Congress, shutting out our, shutting out the media, certainly shutting out the public and the many nonprofits who work in the public interest. But this is really about creating a set of rules for the corporate elites, which, yes, will mean potentially threatening GMO labeling rules, will threaten GMO bans, all in the interest of allowing corporate domination of global agriculture.
One follow-up, Adam. Give us an overview of who is orchestrating these partnerships and how it's being conducted. I understand much of it is being spearheaded out of the U.S. Office of Trade Representatives, which comprise well over 500 corporate representatives, and the steering committee is heavily represented by large multinational corporations. And so explain to us the overall structure behind these agreements and share a little bit about the level of secrecy that, beyond what you just mentioned about them not being able to actually see or take any notes, everything. And finally, wasn't it just last week or so that President Obama visited the round table and promised his full allegiance on this and to convince legislators and the American public that this would be in their best interest? And explain who the business roundtable represents.
Sure. Well, to start from the beginning there, of the companies that are on these advisory committees, it's worth noting that sociologist Ellis Jones compiled a list of the 20 worst companies on the planet. On that list, 9 of the 20 companies on his list are among the corporations on these advisory committees. Those are companies like Kraft, Walmart, Chevron Texaco, General Electric, General Motors, Archer Daniels Midland, agribusiness giant, Verizon, notorious for their anti-labor policies, Procter & Gamble, and the Ford Motor Company. On that same list of these 20 worst companies, 12 of those companies are members of the U.S. Business Coalition for TPP, and those are ExxonMobil, Kraft, Walmart, Chevron, General Electric, General Motors, but also Pfizer, Citigroup, Microsoft, Archer Daniels Midland again, and Procter & Gamble. So really it's the worst of the worst who are influencing these policies. The U.S. Trade Office of the U.S. Trade Representative has been described as a rogue government agency. It is originally an office of the executive, an office of the White House, an office of the executive branch. There's been talk of moving it to Commerce, but this is the U.S. Trade Representative is an appointed official who is largely responsible for negotiating these trade agreements. Congressman Alan Grayson has described the U.S. Office of the U.S. Trade Representative as akin to, basically as a revolving door for corporate lobbyists. The guy who's currently in charge there, Michael Froman, is a former Citigroup guy who was given a package estimated at $4 to $6 million on his way out of Citigroup to thank him for his future good service to our government, ensuring that he would be a loyal corporate hack when he went into quote-unquote public service. People go from the corporations to carry their interests into the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative or work at USTR to curry favor with corporations so that they can leave their government jobs for much more lucrative employment in the private sector. So these are the people who are negotiating on behalf of the United States. We the people are shut out. This is something that we need to understand here is President Obama in this secrecy has exceeded anything that we saw under previous administrations. The Bush administration, when the free trade area of the Americas negotiation was being conducted, as outrageous as that negotiation was in the early 2000s, people could access the negotiating text of that agreement. They learned their lesson from that. They understand now that when the people can see what it is they're negotiating, and the former U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk made statements to this effect. When people can actually see what's being negotiated, they're not able to finish the negotiation because people are just too outraged. So with this extreme secrecy on the current round of negotiations, the three currently being negotiated, the TPP, TTIP, and TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement, they are now trying to close that, to prevent that from happening again by keeping all of us in the dark and with the full complicity of the corporate media, which many of its members are part of the U.S. Business Coalition for TPP, companies like News Corp and Time Warner are part of this coalition. They benefit from some of the intellectual property rules in this agreement as content creators, so they don't want people to know about these agreements. The corporate media has almost completely ignored this issue, particularly the broadcast media has had nothing to say on this issue. Media Matters for America and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting have both remarked on the almost complete silence. Really, the only people in the TV medium who are saying anything on this issue are Ed Schultz on MSNBC and Bill Moyers on PBS. Other than that, the only time these agreements ever get mentioned is to complain about why they're not being moved fast enough. With regards to President Obama, President Obama has come out and said that he will oppose his own party on this issue, that Democrats in Congress are not supportive of fast track, do not want to see more of these job-killing, anti-environmental trade deals, more trade deals that will not create prosperity and jobs at home, but will contribute to more outsourcing of U.S. jobs while endangering our environment and our food and our medicines. But President Obama, it seems, has a lot of a lot of people have said this is a product of who he has as his advisors. He has put the people who caused our financial crisis in charge of telling him what makes sense when, in fact, these trade agreements are very likely going to exacerbate future such problems. One of the most criticized aspects of TPP is that it will prevent bans that will ban capital controls, that it will prevent countries from restricting capital flight, that many of the rules as we saw under the U.S.-Korea FTA, U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, that many rules put in place after the financial collapse to prevent future collapses, bans on toxic derivatives, bans on efforts to prevent too big to fail, will actually be curtailed by these trade agreements on behalf of the Citigroups and the big banks. So unfortunately, it seems like President Obama is more interested in serving the interests of those corporations, many of whom contributed to his reelection, and to listening to the pro-business advisors he surrounded himself with and letting the corporate-controlled USTR call the shots than he is in actually standing with the voters who elected him, with his own party, and with the best interests of this country and, in fact, the world.
You've been listening to Adam Wiseman, and he is the founder and organizer of Global Justice for Animals and the Environment. Now let's go over to Washington, D.C. and say hello to Bill Warren, and he is a senior trade analyst with Friends of the Earth in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, I'm very honored to be on your program, Gary.
There's a lot that has to be discussed that on this issue because it's really a big issue. And if you would, please, address two things. It is my opinion, and I can be wrong on this, that as we speak at this moment in Peru, a party to the TPP, it's hosting the U.S. climate change round of talks. And at the same time this week, the players in the Trans-Pacific Partnership are meeting for another round of negotiations. Now, environmentalists are deeply concerned about the impact these agreements will be having upon the environment and rulings that will likely increase the transportation and exploitation and use of fossil fuels rather than lessen them. So speak on the issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TATIP, being a treaty to a treaty that will cause a threat to the environment, the ecology, and a boom for the fossil fuel industries. And also, on a personal level, I realize it's completely subjective, but I no longer trust any of these international conferences to resolve our issues. I've watched every single one. I've looked at the findings. And after the very beginning ones till today, I've seen no major polluter, not India, not China, not Brazil, or the United States, make the commitments in the short term. They all can say 20 years, 30 years from now, we'll do something. But by that time, it's too late. Of the 32 tipping points, 12 of which are phenomenal, we'll have over half of those tips. And no matter what we do, it will not reverse the impact. And so they play this game of posturing and giving positive insight to what they're going to do and how much they care. And everybody comes away feeling that they've made some difference. And I don't see that difference. I believe that we need something more dramatic. I believe that if all the unions in America, who are going to be just decimated, if the membership forced the leadership, which is frequently in alignment with the corporate interest, to go on general strikes, to bring this message home, start closing down different offices, and then we could have some real attention. Otherwise, I see this as just a Trojan horse. Those are my personal feelings. Please challenge them as you will, and then address the issue I ask you.
Well, Gary, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the threat to the climate and the future of the planet presented by the transatlantic, the Trans-Pacific Agreement, and the fast-track legislation that would grease the skids for the approval of those two dangerous trade deals. Let me tell you, U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman and the Republican congressional leadership, Mitch McConnell and Boehner, are hell-bent on using the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Agreement to increase U.S. coal, oil, and gas exports to the world and thereby fuel global warming and catastrophe. For example, Ambassador Froman has already been apparently successful in challenging a European Union fuel quality directive, which would have limited and discouraged shipments of dirty tar sands oil from Alberta to Europe, and you know would be shipped through the proposed Keystone XL pipeline system for export from U.S. ports. So Froman, has already undermined one of the better climate policies anywhere in the world, the EU Fuel Quality Directive, as just kind of a precondition for these talks with the European Union. In the same way, a leaked proposal by the European Commission bureaucrats proposes for the transatlantic trade agreement energy provisions that would really be intended to expand fossil fuel exports from the United States to the European Union. The current law is very inadequate in the United States. There are some limited licensing regulations for any export of gas, and there's a ban on crude oil exports. But what they want to do is write into international trade law provisions that would guarantee the free flow, the free trade, and the continued expansion of the use of fossil fuels around the world. If you look at the filed Federal Register comments of Chevron and other major energy companies, they're quite explicit about this, and it's obvious that the U.S. Trade Representative's office agrees. And it's utterly hypocritical for Barack Obama to claim to be interested in effective climate action when the biggest danger to the climate right now are these Pacific and Atlantic trade deals. I mean, this will mean free trade in dirty energy products, like tar sands oil, coal from the Powder River Basin, liquefied gas shipped out of West Coast ports to Asia under the TPP. And the result would be more climate change from carbon emissions across the Pacific. So we would just be, it doesn't make any difference whether the carbon emissions come from China or whether they come from California. The thrust of U.S. trade policy is to increase climate emissions and throw the whole planet into into a state of ecological crisis. And really, this is, as the other speakers and you have noted, a matter of deregulation. That's the common theme through all the legal text of these agreements, and it's favoring corporate profits over the intrinsic value of nature. Both the Atlantic deal and the Pacific deal would encourage the use of so-called cost-benefit analysis of environmental and health regulations. And that's utterly at odds with the fundamental principle of environmental regulation, and that's the application of the precautionary principle in the face of what I call immeasurable environmental risk. And it's also an attempt in cost-benefit analysis to attribute a price to the intrinsic value of human life and living things and nature itself. And environmental standards would be lowered if this undervalued benefit of protecting nature is then outweighed by the cost to corporate profits. It's an obscene procedure for evaluating whether environmental and health regulations can go into effect. And it's a central part of both the Atlantic and Pacific deals. And you can go through several categories of environmental regulation where you not only have the cost-benefit analysis, but you would there would be an explicit targeting of good public interest measures. It's criminal.
Bill, let's look at an example and see whether or not this is reasonable to your argument or not. Let's say that you are one of thousands of corporations around the world who decide that they want to market a product in the United States. Let's say they want to market a product that our testing right now would show would be incompatible with our life and health, that it's dangerous. Let's say someone wants to reintroduce DDT into the United States. Would this treaty allow them to deregulate our standards, environmental standards, to allow toxic chemicals, either GMOs or in food or in something like a DDT back in the United States? And if we said, no, that is a danger, it's been proven scientifically it's a danger, could they then turn around and sue the United States, a state or federal government, and say you're depriving us of profits on this, and then have independent arbiters favorable to them without recourse of appeal, then make adjudicate that and then give a ruling that theoretically could mean that they could then say, if you're not going to allow this product to be sold in the United States, the next 5 years where the profits are $5 billion, and that's what they assess us. Is that possible?
Well, it's certainly possible if the corporation in question, you know, was an investor and had a reasonable expectation of future profits going forward, even 20 or 30 years. They could seek monetary compensation from these biased pro-corporate investment tribunals that can run in the millions and in many cases the billions of dollars. I mean, Argentina's facing tens and tens of billions of dollars in liability from investment tribunals. And Ecuador and Venezuela and some other countries have also been hit very, very hard. And it could happen here soon, a lot sooner than maybe even the USTR.
The whole idea
is you're interfering with future profits.
Okay.
And the chemical and pesticide deregulation is one of the worst features of these two agreements, and the provisions that specifically relate to chemicals and pesticide then dovetail with the investment tribunal provisions.
One follow-up for you also on this, Bill, please. When it comes to the environment, would they have any rights that would supersede a state right? Let's say that there is a park, a national park that we hold in common and it is not exploited. Would any foreign power have the ability through these treaties then to come in and exploit that against the public will?
Well, if you look at the investment tribunal suits under existing agreements, one thing you see that a good many of them deal with land use issues. And indeed, there was a major case out of Chile where a large multinational from Malaysia successfully sued Chile because they had plans to take some pristine areas of Chile and build a city from scratch that would have commercial districts, industrial districts, housing, you name it, and it would spoil the environment and you know, did not fit in at all with Chile's plans for sustainable land use. And yet an investment tribunal found that Chile had violated the reasonable expectations of the Malaysian multinational because some trade official at a boozy dinner and had made promises from the podium that they would do whatever they could to facilitate this massive investment in Chile. Now, not a legal document, nothing he could take to court and enforce in any ordinary circumstances, but those sorts of representations were actually used by the tribunal to say that the Malaysian multinational had reasonable expectations to build this disastrous and futuristic city in a pristine place in Chile, and cost the Chilean government a bunch of money. And I think it illustrates your point exactly. And since you're with California, you know how important land use regulation is in California, especially along the coast, but in so many other beautiful and precious areas.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Kevin, back to you. There's still a lot behind the partnership bills that is not public. We know certain sections concerning medicine and patents and food and environment and fossil fuels. And one of the criticisms that I have that these private industries are attempting to force government and others, public services and agencies and various entities to become nothing more than market-based operations. In other words, fascism and in its implementation. And perhaps you can address how this is being implemented for medical drugs and many other commercial products, and how might this affect the nations that have socialized medicine or even Medicare or Medicaid in the United States?
Oh, you're exactly right. Again, and that's the other side of this. We've talked a lot about deregulation, which is, you know, definitely central to how this corporate power expands. But in addition, there is a rigging of the markets in favor of the corporations through patents and copyright laws, and in making not only the pharmaceutical drugs having the ability to patent their products for a longer period of time, but also even things like surgical procedures becoming a commodity that is protected by intellectual property laws. Copyrights of textbooks going for more than 100 years. They're just absolutely bizarre protection given to big business. And you're right, it is a threat to some of the best healthcare systems in the world. The Japanese and Australian, New Zealand, the European healthcare systems that are far advanced to ours, that spend a lot less money and get better results. They're state support enterprises, and these agreements are very opposed to that. And I could see this easily coming back on Medicare as well and forcing privatization. For example, this will force these other countries that have a single-payer type system to allow private insurance to come in and compete and to get all the benefits of the state support enterprises. And so this will be a real destruction of the Japanese, Australian, and European systems. And we can expect much more of a commodity approach, a privatization approach, and much less of an approach of a public good. And then, as was mentioned, you have these tribunals to enforce the laws. I just want to add to the one little point to that. The typical judges on these tribunals will be corporate lawyers on leave from their corporate job, playing the role of a judge in a tribunal, and then when they're done, they'll go back to their corporate job. So that's another part of the rigging of the system in putting in rules that favor these big corporations. And it really is the big corporations. It's the transnationals that can go across borders because they give foreign corporations greater power than domestic corporations, these foreign investors. And so a company like TransCanada will have greater power in the United States than a U.S. corporation would have because their foreign investment would be protected through this tribunal system. And I just wanted to finally add one other point, which was that we talked about the media not doing its job here. And I really want to emphasize to your listeners that shows like yours that cover this issue, shows like ours, Clearing the Fog Radio, that cover it, the independent media, the citizens media, really is the venue for us to get the information out. When you see information on this, share it and spread it. We've gone so far without the corporate media covering this. We've done it because the independent media and the citizens media has been doing their job and reporting this and spreading the word in a very credible way from friend to friend. People you know hear about it from you. It has more credibility than MSNBC or Fox News. And so we really need to emphasize our role here as citizens, not just out in the streets protesting or contacting legislators and lobbying and telephone calls and faxes, but also our role as media outlets ourselves. We can each reach hundreds or thousands of people. We need to do that every opportunity you get. We've stopped the TPP and Fast Track so far because the citizens media, in part, that's one major reason why citizens media is doing its job.
And that's Kevin Zeese. That's Zeese. In Baltimore, he's an attorney and political activist, co-director of It's Our Economy and director of Come Home America. And now let's finish up by going back over to Brooklyn and saying hello to Adam Wiseman. Adam, the areas of your organization, Trade Justice, is focused on has been food products and animal products and GMOs. And earlier this year, we were learning that labeling GMOs would be banned to all signatory parties in the partnerships. And nations such as European countries that banned the importation of GM, meat and dairy, which are laced also with toxic chemicals and growth hormones and antibiotics, would be deregulated, enabling these very toxic products to enter their markets. So provide us with a closing overview about the partnerships and what it will mean for the food we eat and the safety of these food products.
The corporate agribusiness is strongly interested in pushing. Okay, is strongly interested in pushing these agreements. The global trend has been we've seen more and more of a shift globally towards the consumption of animal products, more and more of a shift towards industrially produced foods, more and more of a shift towards corporate control of our global food economy, and these trade agreements are an essential part of that. That's by lowering regulatory standards, that's also by eliminating tariffs that are designed to protect local farmers and traditional economies and traditional farming economies. So this has been an ongoing trend. And part of the reason I think we need to be very concerned about that is as we shift more and more towards industrialized food, more and more towards animal products, this is yet another climate threat. Yet another thing that we need to be worried about in terms of global climate. In Latin America, for example, one of the major driving forces behind the destruction of rainforests is deforestation for livestock feed. Another major area is deforestation for cattle grazing. And as we shift more and more towards this global system of feeding grain to livestock in intensive factory farms, we're seeing more and more of the loss of rainforest in countries like Brazil and in countries like Peru, where these climate talks are currently being held.
I want to thank you, Adam Wiseman and William Warren and Kevin Zeese, for sharing insights on our theme. The theme is The Influence and Corruption of Big Business, a look at neoliberal free trade agreements and partnerships. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.